good start right here. First, I'm Pat, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And I'm a member of Saturday Morning Awareness Meeting. My sobriety date is March 15th in 1983. So I'd like to thank the committee in my head for not giving me too much anxiety and speaking to everybody here. And of course, you know, AD and the people that put this thing together. What a wonderful place this is here. I remember, most of my memories are from Lake Byrd. And that was where Lee got me. Did I shut it off? Lee got me going to the South Florida get-together. And that was at Lake Byrd at that time. And he described it, Maureen did, actually. We used to go to Lee's house on Monday night. And his wife used to say, well, you got to go up to the South Florida get-together in Lake Byrd. The women sit on rocking chairs. In a porch area, and they walk around the lake, and they go to Walmart and shop, whatever. And I'm going, that's the last place I want to go to. And I love Lee dearly, you know. But we went up to it, and we fell in love with the place. I mean, yeah, as you all know, being here, it's a very, very spiritual experience. And I'm the luckiest man in the world. I really am. We are the luckiest people on the face of the planet. When I was coming up here yesterday, before we got ready to leave, I had a young man call me up, and he goes, Pat, I don't have any money. Can you help me out? I'm his payee for Social Security. He's in the rooms, but he's got much larger problems than alcoholism. He's severely bipolar, and he was off his meds. And he says he didn't have any money. So I said, well, maybe you could work at my house and clean something or whatever. When I picked him up at Blue Water Treatment Place Center, he was all over the place, and I knew I couldn't have him come to my house and work on anything. I didn't want him hurting himself. So I took him to 7-Eleven, we got some hot dogs and brought him back, and then I called up the woman that owns the place and asked her if she could help him and take him to Fort Lauderdale Hospital. And, you know, it made me realize just how lucky we are to be alcoholics, that we can do something about our disease. You know, this young man is never going to live in any kind of an environment other than a treatment center or mental health facility. I've been around him. I inherited him from another man at the Coral Ridge Group who was sponsoring him at the time. He came to Florida from St. Louis, and he kind of like got dumped here. His parents were doing drugs and alcohol, and here he was fresh out of a treatment facility. And he's severely bipolar, and his parents are spending the money on drugs, and they have him from one flop house to the other. So when my friend Jack moved up north, he asked me if I would, you know, look after him. And, you know, and I have. I became his payee through Social Security. And it's heart-wrenching. I mean, you know, here is somebody. He's never going to get what we have to the same degree that we have. Maybe there'll be some improvements. So why I came off on this is what happened with me yesterday. So anyway, as my friend Thomas at the Saturday Morning Awareness Meeting would say, this is the best day of my life. And if anybody's ever been to that meeting before, Judy, you know what I'm talking about. He said, this is a treat to be here at an AA meeting. And I may not do everything right in the program, but Lee used to tell me, one thing you can never forget is the first half of the first step. You can never forget that you're powerless over alcohol. And the other thing I've never done, no matter what, life's ups and downs, you know, sometimes my wife doesn't do what I want her to do, or she doesn't cook. She's an excellent cook, and I try to tell her how to change a recipe. Or my kids, you know, they don't do what I want them to do. And, you know, so life has its ups and downs. I've never lost my enthusiasm for the program. This is the you know, for a buck, if you have it, you know, cake and a lot of the times, or donuts a lot of the times, coffee if you want it. This is the best thing in the world. So for anybody that's new, if there's anybody here that is new, you know, take advantage of this. This is a godsend. And I bought into it right from the beginning. you know, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And you have to, the prerequisite, one thing it has to be is you eventually have to be done at some point. Maybe you're not that way when you first come into the rooms, but at some point you have to be done. And if you're not, you're doomed to go out and repeat the same thing over again, because when life's pressures come along, what you're going to do is go back to what you're familiar with. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, instead of going back to a pill or drinking, we're alcoholics, what you're going to do is, you know, what we get to do is go to a meeting, call our sponsor, pray. I was reading in the grapevine for November's thing that kind of like validated what we've known in AA all along. There's a doctor of psychiatry in New York University who has done a 10-year study on alcoholics, people that are members of Alcoholics Anonymous, rather, not just alcoholics. And it's been proven through MRIs and through the people's recovery that prayer and meditation works. And Bill said this back when he wrote the 12 and 12. He said that, you know, a real effort to pray and meditate in your life will change you. And here it's proven by the medical community through MRI studies what it does to the brain, and you see people that they have much better lives. So that's the byproduct of recovery. So before I got to that point, though, I was 16 years old at my friend Jim McClure's house, or P. Roman's house, rather. Jim McClure was my other sidekick, maybe 16 years old, and Pete's parents figured that we were going to drink anyway, so they would allow us to drink in the house. And up north, you have basements. We went in the basement. We were listening to Iron Butterfly, and we were listening to The Doors. I don't want to date myself, but and that music. And we had a great time. And I could never handle a lot of liquor, but I drank a lot of Budweiser beer, as George Thorogood would say. And I got sick and threw up, and it was a lot of fun. And but I had a reckless attitude when I'm drinking. Some people, women, men, become church mice when they're drinking. I'm not one of them. I become loud and reckless, and I'll do, you know, I want to do anything or try anything. So I have to catch my breath. All one long sentence, run-on sentence here. My wife knows me. So anyway, where was I? Sharon? What? Oh, we're in Pete Roman's basement. And you know, I met the love of my life at 15 years old. Alcohol enhanced that experience, as it does, you know, when you go parking or whatever, you know. And I met my second addiction was a girlfriend, and I wasn't maybe an alcoholic right from the get-go, but I was on that road, you know. I didn't drink every day, but when I did drink, I got hammered. So, you know, all of a sudden I'm out of high school, and I'm kind of shiftless. My dad had taught me a trade, but you know, the Vietnam War was going on, so I joined the Army in 1969 and went to Fort Dix, New Jersey. Drinking was very permissible in the military as long as you did what you were supposed to do. After that, I went to advanced infantry training at Fort Gordon, Georgia. Then I went to Fort Bragg, and I went to jump school, and then I went to Vietnam, and I kind of wanted to go. It was like gung-ho and all that stuff until I got there. And then you get there and you're in a real combat area and you see what's going on, and it's a real eye-opener, you know. So drugs and alcohol became an even more important part of my life and my story. So I really lucked out. I ended up being an MP up in a major city up north in Da Nang, Vietnam, which was not as bad as where I could have won. Now, most of the guys I went over with were going to join rifle companies because, you know, that was our training. So I ended up being an MP, and we did guard duty security around this base where all the new Marines were coming into the country, and they were rotating in and out, and we basically confiscated stuff that they were trying to get out of the country and take back to the world. They were trying to take out weapons, body parts, photography, you name it. They were trying to take it out. And our job was to keep the base safe and also make sure they went back as, you know, presentable to society. But I became a changed person. I came back, and that girl that was the love of my life was going with an older man. I was 22. He was 25. He had a Corvette. I didn't have nothing but a drug and alcohol problem at that point. And I was devastated. I let that affect me on what I thought about girls, women, whatever. Probably I would think of them as girls because I was a kid back in those days. I was not very mature. And I let that affect me for many, many years. And I got involved in a lot of, you know, shady stuff when I came back from the overseas. And I didn't work legitimate jobs. I lived with a girl and her kids. We drank and drugged out of the house. One of the kids had been hit by a car and used to wear a football helmet because he had a part of his skull taken out to have relieve the pressure in his brain. And I mean, my friends would come over and they would just be high all the time and we'd be dealing out of the house. It was a real classic example of some low life coming into somebody's life and making a difficult life even more difficult, and that's what I did. And I had another friend of mine, and her dad liked me, and he got me a job at a tire company, and all I did was leave work early, sell stuff to the employees that were there at the place. It was a union job. They kind of couldn't get me out because they couldn't really catch me, but I was making tires on a tire machine, and I had to make, say, 15 or 16 during a shift, and I made like 12 or 13 of them without beads, without sidewalls, without treads. This one big black dude who worked there, I mean, these guys were making $25,000, $30,000 a year back in those days with overtime, and they were supporting their families and raising their kids and buying houses and stuff like that. And I made a mockery of this man's kindness that he showed me, this guy that worked at BF Goodrich Tire Company. And I took off probably 30 straight days in a row. And then the union called up and they said, "You want your job back?" And they said, "We don't think we can get it for you, but we'll try if you want, because that's what unions do." And I said, "Nah, I can't. That's not working. That kind of work's not for me." So then I proceeded to go back to doing whatever I could to hustle a living. I got in a car accident, fighting with a girl, and I was driving to a friend's house. And I used to mix barbiturates with the alcohol, and I was driving the wrong way. My friend lived like that way, and I was going 10 miles that way, and I hit somebody head on, almost killed him. He was driving a 72 Cadillac, and I was driving a 59 Mercury, and it was built like a tank. Those are the cars you could hit with a hammer. You wouldn't put a dent in them. And that's what saved my life. Plus, I didn't catch him flush. I caught him at an angle. And I ended up in the hospital. My dad goes up there, and I had most of my teeth taken out during surgery. And a lot of bone material missing, broke my eye orbit, hit my knee pretty good. And my friends come to the hospital when they found out where I was at. My dad went up there, threatened everybody, said, "You know, you're the reason my son's like this." And I was the reason his son was like this, you know. And my dad was trying to protect me, and he loved me, and he didn't realize the depths of where I was, you know. So anyway, I got out of the hospital, and my friends Pat McGeehan and Keith Kerr, two old Marines, picked me up at the hospital. And it was like an emergency room. My friend's emergency parking area was in a semicircle where they come in, they discharged you there also. And my friends had been picking flowers out of the flower gardens there and bringing them up to my room, and my dad was ready to kill somebody. And as I'm getting in, wheeled into this car in a wheelchair, and my face is swollen up, I got like 40, 50 stitches in my face, my friend handed me a beer, and as I'm putting it to my mouth, I'm going, this is what caused this. I knew it in my heart. You know, I'm 23 years old, and I'm putting this Budweiser to my mouth, and I'm going, what's wrong with me, you know? And then I get that glow came over me, and it was just like it all went away. And things got even worse over the next year. I'm walking around, I didn't have the money to get my teeth fixed. My father didn't want anything to do with me. I got a big gap in my mouth. I was unemployable. I was always drunk or high. And so my buddy and I decided to move to Florida, figuring that we could come down here. And I used to fish when I was a kid. I love it. I still do to this day. And you know, I used to like to go camping you know, do all of the things that, you know, I thought were kind of normal things to do. And what was that chair? Huh? Oh, yeah, we came to Florida. And yeah, sorry about this. My mind's kind of still wasted. So anyway, we came to Florida, you know, and we arrived down here. I remember driving down 95. And we're off of Jacksonville, and my buddy's passed out in the seat next to me, and the sun's coming up on 9. You know, we're on 95. I think it ended in Palm Beach in those days, but we're coming down 95, and I see the sun coming up. My buddy's passed out, and this song comes on by the Eagles. I give you the best of my love, and I'm humming it, thinking, reminiscing about what I did for that girl that I was living with up there, you know, in the house with all of the dealing that was going on and the alcohol and stuff. That's how delusional I was at that point in time. And so we get to Florida, and I actually raised my bottom, and you know, I got to the point where I started making a little bit of money. I went to trade school and learned something to become, you know, have something to be of value to somebody. And we had a tremendous recession back here in those days. And, you know, the houses, it was just like it was in 07 and 08 or whenever the recession was here. And you couldn't buy a job. So it got me, gave me the impetus to go to school. So I went to a school and learned a trade. And started making some money, and I stopped the drugs, and I just, you know, pretty much stuck to the alcohol. And after a few years went by, I started my own business, and I started making a little bit more money. And what do you do when you start making some more money? You go back to your old habits again. Now I could do the same things I was doing when I lived up in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. So I don't know why my bottom was when it was, but. Because there were so many other times you would think a sane person would want to stop drinking, but we're not sane. We're not sane when we drink. I mean, I've listened to so many stories in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're all different. It's an eclectic group, but it's terrifying what you hear from everybody. And it got to that point with me, spiritually and emotionally and physically, where it got to be terrifying. You know, I was just... always going to stop. I would throw the alcohol in a dumpster at the impetus of somebody that cared for me, and then they would go away for a couple days, and I would be crawling in the dumpster getting it. I couldn't wait for somebody to leave my apartment so I could go to the convenience store before they closed on Sunday late in the day. And then one day I had some problems, and I went to a dealer's place, and he wouldn't look at me anymore, and he said, get out of my sight. And I left my brother and his wife and a girl I was going with in a movie theater, and I had the car, and I just left them in there because I was going in and out of the theater. I left them there, and they found me up at Fridays after I went to this guy's house, and he wouldn't look at me. And they found me at TGI Fridays, and they took me back to my place, and I'm laying there that night, and I didn't, the next day I got up and I didn't have anything to drink. And the next day I had this like out of body experience. It's the only way I can describe it, you know, when you have that emotional change and that spiritual change where, you know, you've had enough. And I was reading a big book that somebody had given me a few years earlier, and I felt like I was watching myself from up above. You know, I was looking down and seeing myself and for who I really was. And I said, God, please help me. I can't handle this anymore. I don't want to live like this anymore. And that's what it takes, because alcohol gets such a grip around your neck that you got to get hit pretty bad before you're willing to open your eyes up a little bit to help that might be available. And I had some people in my life all along that were trying to help me, not just that guy that got me that job, but people that were trying to help me because of my drinking. You know, they were making subtle and not so subtle suggestions that there was help available, but I just wouldn't do anything about it. And finally, my brother called me up that day. I had this out-of-body thing, and he said he was committing suicide. He was having some kind of a psychosis due to what he was doing, and I hadn't had a drink for a day. And I asked him where he was, and he said that, I'm not telling you, Pat. I'm just, you know, I want to kill myself. Nancy, his wife, was running around on him. So I figured he was, you know, at his condo where he lived at. And I went over there, his emergency vehicles were taking him out. And he didn't die, but I went to the hospital where he was at, and he had all tubes in him and everything. And he says, Pat, will you help me? And I'm going, I'm thinking to myself, I can't help myself. I can't help myself, you know. My brother's asking me to help him, and I'm just, you know, totally as low as you could possibly get. So I went to the 101 Club in Pompano. I'd heard of the place before, somebody that was a neighbor of mine. And, you know, there was somebody up at the podium like I am, and he was talking about having, well, his name was Jose. He had one eye. I remember that. And he had this just shine about him. And He had described his story as being a farmhand, and he had one foot in the street on Hammondville Road and another one up on the sidewalk, and he peed his pants, and he didn't know whether he was getting on the sidewalk or getting off of it. And he just had this look about him right, you know, then and there, that I saw hope for the first time in my life. I saw somebody that was describing how I'd felt for a long time, but I would mask it with the next drink. And that was my first meeting that I remember. I'd been to one for a DUI in 77 or 78, but at St. Helens or something like that, off on Oakland Park Boulevard, the old Fifth Chapter, years ago. I don't know if any of you are from that area, you'd know what I was talking about. But, you know, I was receptive to help at that point. And I put my hand up at a meeting, and I don't remember what the guy said, but, you know, we went outside afterwards, and he was talking to me, and I couldn't tell you a thing about whether he said, you don't have to feel this way again or anything else, but he was just, you know, a feeling of caring, feeling of somebody who understood, and that you didn't have to be like this anymore if you didn't want to, and keep coming back. That was the big thing, keep coming back. So I had a guy, probably the next meeting, who asked me if I had a sponsor. I said no. He says, well, I'm gonna be your sponsor, and you need to go to this meeting if you wanna, you know, have a better chance of staying sober. And it was the Monday night meeting, the workshop group at Unity Church near where we live right now. My memory's shot. I did one too many shot hit acid, I think, in my time, and drank one too many beers. But anyway, you know, he said, go to the Let's Study the Book group, the workshop group. And so I go there, and I got adopted by all these old timers. It was Wesley P., Wesley Parrish, Bugs, Mac, John Williams. I could go on and on if I could remember them. But these guys were on speaker exchanges, and I found myself at meetings up in Port St. Lucie, down in Miami, all over the place. They were the real deal. And boy, has AA changed since then. I mean, I remember if you mentioned the word, the D word, anywhere, I mean, they would have closed the meeting down and thrown you out, literally. I mean, I was at the workshop group one day when somebody said I was an addict, and Wesley stopped the meeting and told them, I don't care if Jesus came off the cross right now, but, you know, unless you're an alcoholic, we don't want you here. And things have changed a lot over time. But my story is so mixed up with one of them that at one and the other one. But anyway, he was a great friend of Alcoholics Anonymous. I met him one day. He gave me a card. It was at the post office in Pompano. And he said, it said on there, if you want a friend, you have to be a friend. And it showed had a picture of Christ on there. And that's how you can overcome your fear in life, is by being a friend of God. And he was mailing out like 20,000 of these cards to Australia. I think he was instrumental in Alcoholics Anonymous getting its foothold in Australia. These were the kind of people that I ran into. And then Catherine talks about Lee May and Maureen May. I had saw Maureen the last time. It was at the state convention when it was in Bahia Mar. Big people in my life. These people welcomed me into their hearts and into their lives. That's why I felt so at home. They showed me what worked in their lives. I remember it was Frank P. who told me, he was the guy that told me to go to the workshop group. He disappeared. We played golf for a little bit, and he introduced me to people in the rooms, and then he kind of like disappeared. And then Frank P. became my sponsor, Frank Pax, and Frank's passed on. And these guys told me that, Pat, when you get a year, not if you get a year, but when you get a year, you're going to take a meeting to BCIC, and you're gonna give back what was freely given to you. And they sponsored people, and they were active in groups, and you know, they were with me when I picked up my red chip and my blue chip and my medallions. And the debt of gratitude I have for the people that came before me is just so heartfelt. I miss these people. I've got a great sponsor right now. Basically, he just tells me, because I got quite a bit of time and I bitch about the same things all the time, work or whatever. But, what he tells me is just be happy, Pat. Just be happy. And you have high-class problems. That's what Eddie G. tells me. He says, Pat, we have high-class problems. And we do. We do. We could be like that boy that I was at picking up yesterday. You could be walking back from Syria right now with two of the four kids you started with. You know, the other ones maybe got lost at sea or something like that. So I don't know why, you know, I'm so fortunate and why I'm so blessed. But one thing I know is that Lee and Frank and the rest of them showed me how to pass it on. And, it's been a great ride. You know, my wife and I have been together for 30 years. We've been married for 27, maybe we've been married for, been together for 29 years. We've got two adult children. One of them's at a Rotary meeting taking my place right now because I'm not at the Rotary function. I wanted to come up here to Lake Bird when they asked me to speak. I thought it'd be a hoot to be up here sharing at a podium that my friend Lee and various other people have shared at. You know, like the circle goes around like this, and we pass it on to somebody else someday down the road. They showed me how to live. I didn't know how to live when I was describing what was happening to me back in the late 60s, early 70s, up until 83 when I came into the rooms. I didn't know how to live at all. You know, I had parenting that was tough. Their lives were tough. Depression era father. You know, sometimes we can succeed despite what passes for parenting. You know, and the reason why is we get new parents. And, you know, my father, who was a little tough, became my best friend. He died like 3 years ago. I would have missed all of this. Frank called me up and said, if you want to see Lee before he dies, get over to the hospice now on Commercial Boulevard. I got to go there and Maureen put his hand on his her hand on his chest as he was taking his last breaths. And it's not macabre. It's part of life. You live long enough, that's what's going to happen. But he lived a wonderful life. And these are the people that I wanted to be able to emulate. And I didn't want to be like I was. You know, that was, I think, Sharon and my biggest fears was with our kids, that they were going to turn out to be anything like us. And it's funny, you know, because, you know, those are, we told them, you know, it's in the genes. And, you know, one day one of our kids got popped by the police. You know, it was like a Cheech and Chong movie, Up in Smoke, where they roll the window down because the light was out. And, you know, the cops gave them a civil fine. And, you know, they learned their lesson from it, I hope, anyway. My one son was gracious enough to help his friend out. And my son had some money from my dad when my dad passed away. And he actually is generous enough of spirit and love for his friend that he actually, you know, his friend was actually an illegal alien from Colombia, I think it was, and he would have gotten in a lot of trouble. And somehow or another, my son was able to pay. I mean, so even though we were worried about all of this, it all turned out for the greater good anyway. And how about the story, Sharon, about New Year's Eve a few years ago? Should I even say that one? Huh? I should. So, New Year's Eve, 4 years ago maybe, our kid is not quite of legal age to drink. It's the same one, by the way. Sharon and I are coming from an AA party. You know how you barely stay awake until 12 o'clock if you're at an AA party. Everybody has their sweets and their coffee, and by 10 o'clock they're trying to stay awake, you know? And especially Joe B. and some of the old farts that we hang around with, right? So anyway, this party, we're coming from my friend Ted's house. And we're coming down Cypress Road from McNabb Road, and we're heading toward Atlantic, toward where we live. And we see a car weaving in front of us, and he hits the curb. Comes back onto it, and we're going, oh my God, we had this glow about AA glow about how thank God we don't have to deal with that anymore and blah, blah, blah. So we go home, fall asleep about 3 o'clock in the morning, and then we get woken up to the sound of what sounds like a garden hose in our bedroom. And it's our son, 19-year-old son Brent. He doesn't know where he's at, and he's urinating on our carpet. So I go, Brent, you know, Sharon goes, she wakes me up and she goes, look, Brent. So I grab him by the arm and I say, Brent. And I realize that he's, you know, really intoxicated. So I take him into his bedroom and I lay him down, go back to sleep. Next morning, Sharon and I wake up at a normal, like 9 o'clock or something like that, 10 o'clock, and he's still sleeping. So we get some pots and pans and we go into the bedroom and we start banging him over his head. And I go, where's your car at? And he goes, it's in the driveway. I said, no, it's not. Where's your car at? So I go, you were so drunk you didn't know where you were at last night, right? We haven't seen any overt behavior like that since. I find him, he inherited a substantial amount of money from my dad, and I was paying, I wanted him to keep it, you know, so maybe it could go towards something useful after he got out of college, which is what he's still in college right now. And I said, I'm going to give you the fine that you should have gotten from the police if you had got caught. So I said, I'm not paying for your car insurance, your vehicle repairs anymore. I'm not paying for any of that stuff, right? So like a year later when he was out of money, and he went through quite a bit of money partying, and he goes, Dad, I had no idea how much money you were spending. He said, I went through $11,000 in about a year and a half on that stuff. And I'm going, yeah, I mean, you know, you got parents that work their butts off so that you guys can have the things we think you need in life. And college education, we've got them their first cars. Who'd have thought we would have done that, you know, 35, 40 years ago, hon. Who'd have thought that? I mean, it was just, it's been an amazing journey because of the amazing people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am sober by the grace of God and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of recovery. And the people are what makes the program to me. They really are. I mean, I'm not intimately intertwined with a lot of people in the room right now, and I know a lot of people over the years that I've come to know. But not, you know, you only have so many hours in the day, and you can only know so many people that you're really close with. And I have those. But everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know, you watch people transform their lives. It's a game changer for people. They come in and they're wrecks, terrified, false bravado, whatever, and they shine after a while. They're able to. What God gives you, my friend Harry Olson said, what you really get out of life, what you really get from AA is a life. You get a life. I never had one before. I didn't get my life back. I got a new one when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. So is that close enough? I'm going to start repeating myself. That's it. Thank you.